That's Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 21, as we continue to worship the Lord through the reading of his word. Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, that she may be healed and she will live." So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." While he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him. But when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumai," which is translated, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. But he commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and he said that something should be given to her to eat. Please be seated. As we continue the journey through Jesus' ministry chronologically, we come to this point about halfway or more through Jesus' earthly ministry. And Jesus has reached a very high level of popularity at this point. He is just really rising with the tide, if you will. He's riding a huge crest of popularity. He's known throughout the land for his miracles, and as you recall, the majority of his ministry is actually in the northern part of Israel, up in the Capernaum region, which is where this takes place today in our reading. And he's known for his miracles. He's known for his love, his compassion for the common man. He's known for his love for sinners and outcasts, and just his desire to reach people that are that have been thrown away a lot of times, disregarded, neglected. He's well known and loved by the crowds. And wherever he landed, wherever he came into a town, or he drew a crowd wherever he went. He was just a popular man, and he just got off the boat from his nap, if you remember, as he's going across, and the storm rages, and the disciples accuse him of not caring, and so he rebukes the sea and the wind, if you recall, and just dismissing those things completely. While and just showing his disciples not only the power he has over illness, but the very, very power he has over creation, which gets them to ask the question, "Who is this man?" So it's this same day, it's this same trip that he's on, and he hits the other shore, and this great throng of people have gathered around him very, very quickly. He just gets off the boat, and immediately they are surrounding him. People were beginning to place their faith in him, a lot of times, of course, because of the miracles that he was performing, but many people were beginning to place their faith in him, perhaps as the Messiah. And a little later on in the reading, when we get to the two blind men, that's exactly what they say. They call him the Son of David, which is a recognition that he is indeed the Messiah. So people are beginning to understand what his what his role is, what his position is. And they certainly saw this man as somebody who was handy in a time of trouble, somebody that could help them out, somebody that would that could possibly supply the very thing that they needed. But the religious leaders at this point were already coming against him and plotting to kill him by this time. They did not like what it was that he had to offer, and mostly because what he offered more than anything else was the power of God to common people. Now, when we come to these two instances, these two miracles that we're going to see here, and then again the third one a little later on that we see, the thing that we have to come to the conclusion on is that no matter how much money, no matter how much access, no matter how much power, how many resources, at some point in our lives, we will come to the end of our own strength. It may be that for your entire life that you're going to be just fine, but ultimately, at the end of your life, you're going to find something you cannot defeat, and that's death. At some point in our lives, nothing that we hold, nothing that we have will matter. It will not be enough when we come to the end of our own strength. We're faced with something far beyond our ability to correct or even deal with. And it doesn't have to be that ultimate in death. It could be something that we're facing today, just something far beyond our ability to correct or even deal with. The situation may be temporary. It may be permanent. It may have permanent consequences. It may be sudden, or something you've been dealing with for years. You come to the end, and you wonder if there's an answer. We encounter people here in these readings who are at the end of all of their resources. One who has so much, and one who has very little, if anything at all. We encounter a man who has great resources, and they are useless as his daughter faces that ultimate defeat, death. The other, a woman who had endured a debilitating illness for 12 years and had nothing left. And then finally, when we get to the two blind men, we get these two blind men who went to great lengths to follow Jesus. Even though they could not see, I think that they saw far greater than many of us do today. And these were all answered in faith. The first one that we encounter is a ruler among the Jews, it says, and he asks Jesus to heal his daughter. But let's look at how it was that he came to Jesus. First of all, this is a man, it says, a ruler came and worshipped him. In Matthew, it says in Mark, it says it fell at his feet. And in Matthew, it says he worshipped him. And we have to notice that this man worshipped him. And then Jesus received this worship, which would have been blasphemous if Jesus had not himself been God. Throughout the Bible, if it is somebody who is receiving worship, like an angel in Revelation, or in Acts 10, I believe it was Paul that was, or excuse me, it was Peter that was, was worshipped. And they said, no, don't you do that, because that would be blasphemous to receive that kind of worship. Jesus received it, which is important enough to understand by itself. But we also have to understand who Jairus is. He is a leader of the Jews. He is a ruler of the synagogue. And he is responsible for the care and the facility and the order of the service. And he was a man of high ranking in town and within the Jewish faith, and he is coming and he is worshiping this Jewish carpenter from Nazareth. That says something. And Jesus receives it. Now, the fact that he's a ruler of the synagogue also means he has a position of prestige, and he also has a position of some wealth. So this is a powerful man, at least in that little town. A very powerful man. And he comes and he falls before Jesus and he says, my daughter, it says in Matthew, it says, my daughter has just died. Here it says, she says it was very sick. Basically, it has been rightly been given a diagnosis of a fatal illness. So in his own mind, his daughter is already gone, even though she still lives. He's already gone. And the very thought being that there was no hope short of a touch by God. So he comes to whom he knows he believes to be God. When he comes to Jesus. Now, this ruler did the right thing in coming to Jesus, but his faith if you compare him to the centurion in Matthew 8, his faith is small. He thinks that Jesus needs to be in the presence of his daughter. He needs to touch her in order to be healed, not quite understanding that the God of the universe is in his presence and that he can do just by speaking it into his existence that this healing would occur. And so the ruler thought it essential that Jesus come and touch the little girl. The centurion said, I'm not worthy that you would come into my home. Just speak the word, and my servant will be healed. But being a ruler, what he saw was his reputation. What he saw was his position. And then he saw his daughter. And what trumped was his daughter dying. And so he risked all of that in order to come to this man who is now hated by the religious establishment. And I don't think he really cared at this point what his colleagues thought, because his daughter was dying. Now, there's something in the healthcare world called the million-dollar patient. We're all going to get to that point, I think. You know, we're going to have family members that get to that point where we recognize that there's absolutely nothing we will not do in order to bring some healing, some comfort, something, whatever the medical community can provide. And the reason why they're called a million-dollar patient, because in those final days, weeks, and months, that's how much is spent in order to sustain life and hopefully try to reverse what's going on in a fatally ill person. But at that point, we don't care, do we? It's whatever it takes. And so the medical community refers to them as a million-dollar patient. So in that respect, that's exactly what Jairus is looking at. He's saying, it doesn't matter. I'm going to do whatever is necessary for my daughter. You guys don't feel that way about your kids, do you? Of course you do. Whatever it takes. And so he's going to Jesus. Now, he had known about Jesus for a long time, but it's times like this that brought him to Jesus. There's a difference between knowing about Jesus and coming to him. You know, but up to this point, he had no need for Jesus. He was doing just fine on his own. We know that person whose life is undisturbed, untouched by tragedy or problems they can't yet handle. And so they might know about Jesus, but they've not yet gotten to the point where they need him, where they believe that they need him, even though their need for him is well beyond what they can possibly imagine. Even if their life is smoothly sailing, they still don't seem to know that at the end of their life, man, the bridge is out. Sometimes the Lord's going to bring great trauma into a person's life in order to grab their attention. That was part of my own story. My own son was, 36 hours after being born, was whisked away into a NICU for the next, week, I think, was whisked away into a NICU, and we'd had no idea if the son that we'd waited so long for was even going to live. And so, I remember just pacing up and down in front of the hospital, this, fist-shaking, rebellious little atheist, looking up and saying, God, if you exist and you give me my son, the best promise I could come up with at the time is, I'll go to church. Part of my own story. 18 months later, I get a tap on my shoulder. At the time, I didn't realize, but it was the Lord. And he said, you remember that promise? And the way he did that was because I heard a rumor in the job that I was in. You know, every week somebody was getting fired, and I had heard that it was kind of it was my turn. My number had come up, and so I was just freaking out. And so my wife, bless her heart, invited me to church, and I went, and the Lord met me in this big church. There was no altar call. There was no. I mean, it wasn't the message, it wasn't the music, it was anything else. It was because I was at this point where there was such great trauma in my life that the Lord met me. Sometimes the Lord's going to bring great trauma into a person's life in order to grab their attention. Last week we talked about the storm, and that was, again, there are correcting storms and there are perfecting storms. And as we grow as a Christian, a lot of times we'll get into those perfecting storms where Jesus is testing our faith and where Jesus is trying to bring us to a point of understanding that he is the source of all of our strength and he is the focus of our faith. But if you're not a believer, he might bring tragedy into your life in order that you might finally begin to look at him. You might finally turn to him. How many times have there been somebody in our own life that needs to come to know the Lord and they're in this really tough situation? And how is it that we pray? We say, Lord, just use this to open their eyes for how much they need you. That's where Jairus is. See, Jairus was a very religious man. And religious people need to come to Jesus as well. And unfortunately, our religion often allows us to forget our faith. That is such a tragic thing when our religion allows us to forget our faith and forget the object of our faith. You know, one of the difficulties that I see in the modern church today is that we've become very proficient at making disciples of the church, not of Jesus. We make disciples of the church, not disciples of Jesus. We make religious people. We make folks that love their church. They love what's going on, but they have no idea who Jesus is. There's no church, no religion, no morality that will replace our need for God himself. And it's when we come to the end of ourselves that we finally realize that. It's when we come to the end of ourselves that we realize, as wonderful as our church is, they cannot solve what's going on in my life. So Jairus comes and he throws himself at the feet of Jesus and he says, please come heal my daughter. And you can imagine the hope that springs up in his heart as Jesus begins to walk with him. There's hope finally for my daughter. Something's going to happen. Jesus is with me. And finally, a reason to consider that things will be okay. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of all this, you can imagine they're pushing through the crowd, and Jairus and Jesus are walking together, and they're walking towards his home. And then all of a sudden, Jesus stops and he looks around, and he's looking for somebody in the crowd. It says suddenly a woman, reached up and grabbed the hem of his garment. It grabbed the tassel that was on the end of his clothing that every good Jewish man would wear, just grabbing onto it because her heart, she simply wanted to see the power of God. She was so desperate for anything at all. Now, the King James Version says that the woman had an issue of blood. I personally like that because we all have issues, don't we? We all have issues. This particular woman had an issue that had to do with her physical problem. 12 years she's been dealing with this. Now, we later find out that Jairus' daughter was 12 at this time, so this woman had been dealing with this as long as the girl had been alive. She had been dealing with this problem. And I appreciate the New Living Translation of Mark 5:26, I think there's a humor in it. It says she had suffered a great deal from many doctors, and over the years she had spent everything she had to pay them, but she'd gotten no better. In fact, she'd gotten worse. You've never felt that way, have you? And that's not a criticism of the medical community. I mean, we have to understand that they are men at best and women at best, with a very flawed understanding of the totality of all that goes on. You know, we're still discovering things, on a daily basis of stuff that we didn't know just 5 years ago and 10 years ago, and we think we've got a handle on it. So, I just look for competence and compassion in a doctor. I'm not looking for total answers, because I know my end. But it says she had suffered a great deal from many doctors. And we won't even get into some of the stuff that they all, that you know that that if you do a little bit of research, the things that that they told her to do was more like witchcraft than anything else. So imagine the state of her body. She's anemic. She's weakened. 12 years of bleeding. The state of her well-being, she was broke, having spent all she had on doctors. The state of her heart, she was unable to participate in services because of her ceremonial uncleanness, unable to enjoy the affections of her husband and family because any touch from her would render them unclean. At the end of her resources, without hope. And she says, if only I may touch his garment, I shall be made well. Because her condition was so embarrassing, because it was so personal, because she was ceremoniously unclean, and she would be condemned for touching Jesus or even being in the crowd. Think about that. She's in a pressing crowd. To even being in the crowd, she was trying to do this as secretly as possible. She didn't come running up and ask Jesus openly to be healed. She said, if I can only touch his garment. Now, as we get older, as we get a little more sophisticated in our theology, we realize that her faith was somewhat imperfect, almost superstitious. If I can only touch his garment. But man, it was enough to receive what Jesus wanted to give her. And so this 12-year-old disease was immediately and permanently cured. So in verse 30 it says, and Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? And the disciples were like, are you kidding me? Everybody touched your clothes. What do you mean? Well, Jesus had felt some power going out because of this, and it wasn't because somebody touched his clothes per se, but because of the faith that was in this woman, and she healed him. In his spirit, he had healed her. And so, you know, so you think about this and imagine Jairus, he's still thinking, you know, Jesus has limitations. You got to get to my daughter. And all of a sudden he's stopping and he's looking for somebody in a crowd saying, who touched me? And he's like, come on, Jesus. You know, regardless of the actual size of the crisis in our life, our personal crisis is the greatest one in the world, is it not? And especially if we think Jesus has limitations. So he looks at her. Pay attention to this. He says, be of cheer, good cheer, daughter. Your faith has made you well. So this woman hopes to receive something from Jesus. She doesn't want any attention to herself. She doesn't want any attention drawn to her embarrassing problem. But Jesus insisted on making public notice of her. And he did it for good reasons. He wanted her to know that she was healed, not just temporarily, permanently healed. He wanted to know everybody. He wanted everybody else to know that she was healed. He wanted her to know why she was healed, that it was by her faith, not because of the superstitious touch. There is nothing else in Scripture that tells us that that is the method of healing, is that we have to touch some remnant, some garment. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of superstition and a lot of mysticism around, for instance, the remnants of the cross, you know, that is that some people believe is still around, and as a matter of fact, pieces of the remnants of the cross are supposed to be in the altars of the Catholic Church. You know, whether it's actually true or not, I don't know whether that's the true remnant or not, but you know, there seems to be something in all the remnants and stuff that we collect, thinking that somehow this is supposed to be, you know, something. You know, as a matter of fact, Moses, if you remember, or not Moses, I'm sorry, one of the future kings whose name escapes me at the moment, when Moses' staff was used to, you know, we raised it up and it had the serpent on it, and it was raised up to heal everybody who had suffered from serpent bites, then that became an object of worship later on in Israel. And the king at the time took it and he threw it down and he broke it, this relic of faith amongst the nation. And he said, Nehushtan, this is a thing. And that's the way that we should observe these things, you know, this stuff. You know, there are no religious relics. There are no talismans. There's nothing that's going to bring us faith. There's no prayer cloths. There's none of that stuff that's going to bring any kind of healing to you at all, that's going to bring any type of wealth into your life at all, any type of prosperity. And then a superstition. Yeah, that's all it is, a superstition. And so we look at the woman and say, oh my gosh, you know, she touched the hem of his garment and she gets healed. That's so superstitious. But he says, I want you to understand it was your faith. He brought her to everybody's attention because he didn't want her to think she'd stolen a blessing from him and that she had nothing to hide. He did it because he wanted the ruler of the synagogue, Jairus, to say, this is the power that I have. And then he did it so he could bless her in a very special way. He gave her an honored title. You never hear Jesus call anybody else daughter. What does that mean? He welcomed her into the family of God because of her faith, a term of endearment. Your faith has saved you, daughter. So even though her faith had these elements of error and superstition, she believed in the healing power of Jesus, and his garment saved her as a point of contact for that faith. So there are many things that we can find wrong with this woman's faith, yet her faith was in Jesus. The object of her faith is much more important than the quality or even the quantity. I personally would rather surrender the sophistication of theology for the simplicity of such great faith. When was the last time we reached out in desperate faith instead of religious maturity? Having knowledge of my desperate need for Jesus, that I would push through everything just to grasp the hem of his garment. Even pushing past the throng of my own thoughts, to have that point of faith that Christ is willing to honor, especially after enduring an issue so long that it's become a part of our identity, it's become a part of who we are. And we say, no, Lord, this is not what you intended for me. For those of you who are in that situation to feel like you've grasped on the hem of his garment so tight that you're being dragged, I don't want this to be any kind of condemnation. I commend your faith. And there are some saints that I know and love that are in difficult situations, whether it's family situations or health situations, where they are in this sense of desperation and they are desperately crying out. They are just holding on. And as a matter of fact, that is their hope, is that holding on to the hem of his garment. I commend your faith. And I know somehow, some way, God's going to honor it. But if you haven't, man, if you're still trying to figure things out theologically, if you're still trying to figure out the where's and the why's of how you're supposed to be asking God for these things, abandon it and just go for it. Cry it in desperation that God might bring healing, that God might bring restoration to this situation. So about this time, Jairus is looking at things going on. About this time, the woman is being healed and she's being heralded for her faith in this crowd. Can you imagine a worse situation than having seen this woman being healed? You hear word from your own home. Why trouble the teacher any further? Your child is dead. Again, thinking that his physical presence was needed to perform the miracle. And, you know, it's too late anyway. Death is beyond anyone's realm of influence, even though Jesus had done this yet before. And so he looks and he says something that I just desire that we all capture. He says, do not be afraid, only believe. You keep trusting me. It is really difficult in the fog of these things to process any one thing, let alone many things. And in our best efforts, we try and encourage people. We try and say the right thing, and we try and bring them. You know, you ought to do this. You should do this. You know, make sure you do this. You know, and you know, we're taught in grief counseling about something called the ministry of presence, which is it's just basically to remind people, I'm here. I'm here. And sometimes that's all somebody needs, is to just reach out and recognize that somebody's there. And so Jesus, in this fog, in this new reality that Jairus has, that his daughter is now dead, Jesus gives him the one thing to grasp. I'm here. Do not be afraid. Only believe. That is what we need to carry away from this more than anything else. Do not be afraid. Only believe. Only is an operative word there. Don't do anything else but believe. So he comes in, and it says in Matthew 8, he comes up upon this noisy crowd. And basically what happens is in the Jewish faith, whenever anybody dies, they bury them immediately. I mean, that day. And that's, as a matter of fact, that's still what happens today in the Middle East, both in the Jewish faith and in the Muslim faith. As soon as somebody's dead, they carry him, they could cut him off and bury him. But here, they would hire professional mourners that would be at least two flute players and a wailing woman. And if you've ever heard wailing, you know, people wailing in the Middle East, it is emotional, and it is loud, and it is long, and it is, and so this is, it says this flute players and the noisy crowd, and so they're wailing. So the Jairus is a very rich man. You've got to think that there's a crowd here, and they're wailing. And basically, what that is the family is mourning, and they are dealing with the death, and they're preparing for this time of burial. And so these professional mourners, are letting the rest of the community know what has happened, as well as expressing for them the grief that they themselves cannot express. And so that's what that's all about. You know, but unfortunately, just like anything else, it's been reduced to a system. You know, and so they're out there, and they're doing this professional mourning, and Jesus comes in and says, you know, why are you so noisy? She's only asleep. And so they begin to mock him. They begin to scorn him and say, you know, who is this guy? You know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And so it says, when the crowd was put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose. You know, he spoke to her, said, little girl, arise. Jesus endured the scorn from the crowd and raised the girl to life. And what he did was he invited Peter, James, and John, and he invited Jairus and his wife in to see this situation. And he, you know, he kicks everybody else out. He says, you know, you need to get out of here. And he brings them into the situation. And you know, the thing that I pull out of this is that not only did Jesus not let the criticism or mocking of the crowd keep him from doing God's will, but also don't ever feel guilty about kicking out mockers and scorners of your faith in Jesus Christ. If somebody starts mocking you or scorning you because of your faith, see ya. Wouldn't want to be ya. Don't need ya. Because I'm going to do what God has called me to do. Now here's the thing. Jesus didn't raise every dead child he encountered. He's not going to heal every person that he encounters in his ministry. He doesn't today. Jesus did so here in a simple act of mercy and compassion to this grieving father. Jesus hated death, and I'm sure he took great pleasure in cheating death out of one more victim. But it's not always going to come to that point. So we can either recognize that Jesus still has a hand in this. Regardless of what the outcome is, Jesus still has a hand in this. And let him take us by the hand. Or we can walk around in fear. We can walk around in faithlessness. So if you would turn with me to Matthew as we finish up. Matthew chapter 8. My apologies, chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, starting in verse 27. This is still the same situation. This is still the same day. As a matter of fact, it's immediately after. Starting in verse 27, he says, "When Jesus departed from there, two blind men following him, crying out and saying, 'Son of David, have mercy on us.' And when he had come into the house, the blind men came to him. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you believe that I am able to do this?' They said to him, 'Yes, Lord.' Then he touched their eyes, saying, 'According to your faith, let it be to you.' And their eyes were opened. And Jesus sternly warned them, saying, 'See that no one knows it.' But when they had departed, they spread the news about him in all that country." You bet they did. So these two blind men follow him, and it's not easy for these blind men to follow Jesus, but they did. You know, they had to ask where he's going, you know, where is he now? You know, have we still lost him? Are we still following him? They had to listen to everything so they might, you know, they're probably following the crowd, of course, since Jesus had a tendency to attract them. So they were determined to follow him to the best of their ability. I ask the same of you and of me. Follow Jesus to the best of your ability. And they finally get within range of him, and they say, "Son of David, have mercy on us." So these two blind men follow Jesus, and they're they're openly, they are shouting out this recognition of Jesus as Messiah. The Son of David has no other meaning except Messiah. And so they're saying, "Son of David, have mercy on us." And what they did was they also came to him with an understanding, not because we deserve it, not because we desire it, but out of your mercy, please, Lord, heal us. When you're grasping onto that robe in desperation, it's not because you deserve it. It's not because this is what is going to make your life complete. It's because you know that God is God of mercy. Now, these blind men, it says in John 9 that these blind men are in big trouble, because the Pharisees judged that anybody who would proclaim Jesus as the Messiah, as the Christ, would be removed from the synagogue. So there was a price to pay, but they didn't seem to care because they knew who this man is. It says, when he had come into the house, the blind man came to him, and so then he's healing them in private, and he says, you know, and what he says here is, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" And they answered in faith, "Yes, Lord." Spurgeon says it like this: "He touched them with his hand, but they must also touch him with their faith." So he says again, "According to your faith, let it be so." The scripture here is emphasizing the proper faith that men should have, not in faith, but in Jesus, and the blessings that come to men through that faith. And he's saying the same thing to us today: according to your faith, let it be so. That doesn't mean in proportion to your faith, but rather since you believe, your request is granted. These men had the faith to follow Jesus, and that meant that they forsook other paths, other directions, and they had the faith to cry out, willing to put their words their desire to words, even to the point where they were willing to risk being rejected by their community. They were not afraid to identify with Christ and who Christ is. And they had the faith to asking for mercy, knowing that they didn't deserve healing, but they simply desired it. And they had the faith to say, when he said, "Do you believe these things?" They had the faith to say, "Yes, Lord." So we have three. Let's take this home. We have three instances here of these measures of faith, all of them so beautifully imperfect, so beautifully flawed, because they illustrate to us that it is in our desperate need for Christ that we find that voice, that we find that faith that we need. I would encourage you, if you've been if you've been taught that there's a certain way that we need to approach Jesus, other than as Jairus did, falling at his feet, man, that's about it. If you've been taught that there's a, you know, that there's a certain formula to the prayer, that there's a certain way you need to ask, that there is, you know, that I need to do these three things in order to make sure that Jesus has properly heard my petition, and I have explained to him perfectly what it is that needs to happen, disregard it. Press through the crowd. Press through the thoughts. Press through the fog in your own mind. Grab onto his robe. Grab onto the hem of his garment. You follow him as best you can, like the blind men did. You follow him as best you can. You have that faith. And we take to heart exactly what Jesus said. Do not be afraid, only believe. Now we normally, since this is the last day of the month, we normally spend a few minutes in prayer.